From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a dark corner of the Washington, D.C. Metro platform. Wearing a disguise, the soon-to-be Vice President of the United States was meeting with a journalist, and the Vice President wanted to reach out about their work and relationship. This was a chance for a restart between the two, that's all. Then, suddenly, the Vice President shoved the reporter into the path of a coming train. No one saw it happen. It looked like a suicide. The reporter, Zoe Barnes, was a victim of this relentless political climber named Frank Underwood. Just imagine, the Vice President of the United States committing a murder in public. That is just one of the moments that shocked audiences of the Netflix series House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright. A show this daring needs a soundtrack, of course, and the score for the show just might be the best television score I've ever heard. The man who composed it is Jeff Beal, who just happens to be a graduate of the Eastman School of Music. Let's listen to some of his work. Jeff and Joan Beal are back in Rochester where they first met. This week they're spending several days in residence at Eastman teaching and meeting with students, and then Sunday night they're offering a free public concert in Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater, the concert called An Evening of Film and Film Music. But first, they're on Connections for the Hour. Jeff and Joan Beal, my great pleasure to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Evan. Good to meet you.
And also with us is Donald Huntsberger, Professor Emeritus of Conducting at Eastman, who's going to be a big part of what's going on Sunday night as well. And Donald, great to see you as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
Donald, first of all, let's just get your review of the music we just heard. I think it's fabulous. What do you think?
It is. I mean, everything is fascinating because it gives you the feeling that you better stick around. Something's going to happen.
It is almost 2 minutes, at least the portion that we hear for the television, and yet every time during the opening credits, I watch every moment of it. It doesn't hurt that the cinematography is beautiful that goes with it. But Jeff, it is great work, and I want to know how it came to you in the first place.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. It's funny. It is a long sequence. I thought we were going to have a shorter version. We may not show that whole long version each time, but they chose to do it, and I was really pleased to hear a lot of people say what you say, you know, that they actually stick around. And to me, it's one of the nice things. It doesn't happen on network TV, but it happens on cable and now on Netflix, is that people sort of rediscovered the beauty of a main title sequence, a longer main title sequence. As a composer, it's great because it gives us time to establish a sound for a show, and it's something that you settle into the world. For this particular one, I actually met with the director and executive producer, David Fincher, months before he'd started even shooting, and we sort of had an initial sit-down meeting, and he had already sent me four scripts from the first season of House of Cards, written by Bo Willimon, which is adapted from the UK one. And David is a very wonderful director. I've been a fan of his for years. We'd done a commercial together about maybe 7 years ago, and so I know that because he comes from the music video world, he gets very inspired by music. So after the meeting, I get a call from his producer saying, "Hey, David would love it if you would maybe do a few sketches for him before he starts shooting." I thought this would be a lot of fun, you know. It's probably like maybe it's a little audition too, which is fine, but. So, you know, kind of based on the scripts and the musical direction, I wrote four sketches. And one of those sketches really is The Bones. If you listen to it now, it's much more stripped down, but it's basically The Bones with that tune. And in the meeting, we talked about sort of this idea of a call to arms, you know, that even though it's a very evil politician, you know, that we do still want to evoke the grandeur of Washington and the stakes, those stakes. So, you know, one of the sketches just had this sort of undulating bass line and this very simple, almost anthemic little tune over it, and that was the sort of germ of the idea.
Now, Jeff's work has encompassed a number of shows, many that our listeners might not realize that you're the man behind the music for, and we're going to be hearing some clips of that coming up this hour. As we talk about House of Cards, we talk about their connection to Rochester. I can't wait to get the story of how they met here, and it's also important to point out that Jeff and Joan are very much a team in music, in life, and so much of what they do. And you may not realize when you hear House of Cards that occasionally you hear Joan's voice. Can we hear some of the vocals? Now, there's a spoiler rule this hour.
I like your rule, by the way.
My wife and I are on episode 2 of season 3. We've watched the first 2 seasons. If If you're worried about season three spoilers, there will be no spoilers this hour. But seasons one and two are fair game because they're at least a year old.
Yep, you better have watched it.
That's
fair. Or turn off your radio now.
It's fair, isn't it? I think it's fair.
I think it's totally fair.
End of season two, Frank Underwood finally walks into the Oval Office for the first time, and you have this moment where Claire says, "You know, you go ahead, kind of soak it in first." And instead of sometimes in dramatic scenes where someone finally reaches the pinnacle and it's this triumph. With Frank, it's a triumph of sort of an underhanded triumph. And so the music is a little bit more, well, Machiavellian.
Yeah, that's a good word
And let's listen to some of Joan's vocals that you might not have realized. It's Jeff's wife's beautiful vocals underpinning this moment of Frank in the Oval Office. Yeah, that doesn't sound like someone, you know, winning the Olympic Games. That sounds like someone who is where they should not be, and the rest of the world hasn't figured it out yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll let Joan talk in a second, but as a composer, and I want to hear what she has to say about this, but there is almost no other show in that I can think of where you could say to somebody, I want to have an operatic soprano belting at the top of her lungs under your show. And they most people would throw that cue out or fire you. But that thing I love about House of Cards is everything's larger than life. So the idea that, like you say, this incredibly elevated sense of dark victory, this, like, it just felt like the right thing. So I'm very fortunate that my wife, Joan, is, you know, it's also convenient. Hey, come in here for a second. I got something for you to do.
And Joan, you met him while you were singing at Eastman, right?
That's correct. I was a sophomore at Eastman School of Music, and Jeff was assigned to me as my little brother by the orientation committee. And we wrote letters over the summer, and I got to know this really wonderfully verbal, talented trumpet player via the Postal Service, which doesn't happen anymore.
That was before the internet was invented.
Yes. Yeah. For our younger listeners, the Postal Service, you would put a stamp on something and an actual physical envelope. You put a piece of paper inside.
Yeah.
Very
so
quaint.
You wrote letters to each other throughout the summer?
We wrote letters over the summer, and then I met Jeff, and he was just a funny, talented little squirt. He was a freshman. And, you know, we became good friends, and then I went and heard him play jazz at JP's Jazz Club, and the rest is history. I just fell for this amazingly talented, funny, smart, adorable young man.
You're too kind.
It's true.
It was then, you know.
Still cute.
I think I fell in love with her first because her letter floored me because Joan, aside from being a wonderful singer, her father, who went to Eastman as a trumpet player with his twin brother back in the 40s, 50s?
50s with Donald Hunsberger.
Careful.
All right, never mind. With someone else. And, you know, she played trumpet when she was a kid and was a great trumpet player. So when she wrote me this letter, she said, she knew I was a trumpet player. And she said, is your favorite trumpet player Maurice or Miles? And she kind of had me at that line. I knew I'd met the woman of my dreams because no girl I'd ever met up to that age knew who those two, Maurice Andre and Miles Davis, were, like, two of my big heroes, still are, of the trumpet. So, you know, it was kind of love at first word, in a sense, for me.
Yep.
Well, and was there a right answer between Maurice and Miles?
No, that's the nice thing. It's an existential question, and it's an existential question that you simply cannot answer because they're both the masters of what they do, so...
Yeah. What a great story. And you've been together ever since, been married 25 years?
31 years.
31. I was a senior in Eastman when I got married.
Yeah.
You've been married 31 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
31.
Mm-hmm. 31.
Well, congratulations. and the host's research department failed on that one.
Oh, that's okay.
The NPR story was incorrect. Tim Grieving blew
That's a fact.
How did we all get 25? Where did that
Tim Grieving, NPR.
I went on NPR.
Oh,
so we'll correct this on public
We're
radio.
Going on record. It's
so
really
it's been 31 years.
But it seems like 50.
31 years. And
seems like, yeah. I got a big laugh from our engineer in the booth. Yeah, I know. We feel your pain.
Now,
at a certain point, you just give up.
We're talking to Jeff and Joan Beal, who are back in Rochester. They are in residence this week, doing some teaching, meeting with students, telling them about their experiences. Then it's going to culminate in Sunday night for an evening of film and film music, 8 p.m. Sunday at the Eastman School of Music's Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater. It is a concert that is free and open to the public. Jeff and Joan, of course, will be there. Donald Hunsberger will be there. And I assume we're going to hear some House of Cards.
Yeah, and I really want to hear what Don's going to do, because there's some really cool stories between his history and the school.
It's House of Cards and a lot more.
But I want to answer that question.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad at your spoiler rule, because after doing 3 seasons of the show, it's been so much fun to write for that I just feel like I've got to find a way to bring this out to audiences. So we're basically doing a workshop of a piece on the whole second half of something I'm calling the House of Cards Symphony, where I basically pull together, you know, some of my favorite music over the 3 seasons. And once I had sort of had that musical structure together, I was sort of thinking it as I was going through, but I've sort of choreographed footage from the show to match the music. So there's a little bit of plot in this footage, okay? But there's a few plot points, but the only real plot points that you might be spoiled of would be a couple season 2 plot points. Nothing beyond that has really...
So we're all operating with the season 3 rule. Season 2 and
yeah,
earlier...
Yeah, although I would say, though, no, you know, apologies. I think sometimes this whole idea of spoilers, you can get too invested in that. I mean, it's really the journey that's so fascinating. I mean, we kind of know what a Machiavellian journey is going to be, but... you know, I do. I'm really curious to hear from people. I'm hoping we fill the packed Kodak Hall, because it's amazing. We got 80 students, and this is a grassroots orchestra that was started by students with the whole idea, like, we want to play film music. And this is happening in professional orchestras and now in student orchestras. You know, the orchestral musician of the future is going to be playing this. This is sort of creeping into our concert halls as literature. You know, so they're so talented. And I'm going to be really curious for the people that come. I want to hear from people that have seen the show and haven't seen the show. I don't know if you, when you used to see movie trailer. I remember when I used to. Now it feels like movie trailers give away the whole plot. I love the movie trailers where it was like, oh, that's a fascinating world. I don't know a lot about it, but I want to go there. And that's kind of how I felt like when I was cutting together this footage. I kind of wanted to intrigue you by the footage
without giving it. You're right. There are some trails. They actually show you an ending scene, or
yeah,
you know, it's pretty remarkable. I guess I think that's how they get you in the
theater.
Yeah, and then not
on the,
us, though.
And then,
not
the,
us.
And then on the first half, I'm going to do, I've done a few silent movie scores. One for, I did a whole score of a Buster Keaton film, so we're going to do a section of that, so a short section of that. I did a modern day silent movie starring William Hurt that was an adaptation of a Stephen King anthology I did for TNT that no lines of dialogue are spoken. I'm going to do a section of that, so it's going to be fun. We're going to have a nice mixture of music.
And a little Phantom as well? Is that right, Donald?
That's correct.
All right, yes. Tell us about that.
Well, when I remember these guys coming into school back in the 80s, at that time I had gotten started working with silent films. And people in Rochester don't realize that the whole film industry in one way, started right here in town. Thomas Edison was working in New Jersey putting together machines to show individual viewer-type shots, camera shots, and George Eastman's people came along and developed flexible film. Huh. It was always very stiff before then, and as soon as they got the flexible film, then they could put it into reels, and you could get more than just 16 seconds or something of the kind. And so back in the late 70s, a very good friend of both Jeff's and Joan and mine, Ray Wright, who I'd been working with from back in the 50s, where I studied with him down in New York, and he was the writer who eventually, he was at Radio City Music Hall as the instrumental director. And then he became the code music director of the whole place. And he would come up every summer and we would put on an arranger's workshop or lab institute. And I was hired to be his local in-residence guy, since I knew him and we worked together. And so Ray would come in and have these wonderful sessions. Then we'd put on a live concert at the end of the 3 weeks, which was to do exactly what Jeff is doing now, where he gets an assignment and you've got to have this ready. Well, at the end of the first week of the Arrangers Lab Institute, Ray and Manny Album would go over to a blackboard and would discuss with the class what the show was going to be in 2 weeks. At which time, after they got the whole thing laid out and assigned everybody, everybody split and went back home, besides just continually writing for everything else, went home and and wrote the show, which was then rehearsed the last week and put on in the theater live Friday night. And I mean, this was, you know, this is how you learn.
Yeah.
You learn
That's
the
right.
business.
Yeah.
And there was no wiggle room. I mean, it either worked or it didn't. And Ray was such a wonderful teacher that he could listen to something and he'd say, now, what you should do here is this, 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 and this. And you go ahead and you do it. Bang. Suddenly, the problem's solved.
Yeah.
But anyway, he had done a concert for the RPO on their 50th anniversary. And they hired him to come in and do this celebration. And he said, well, what I'm going to do is reproduce a concert, a show from the 20s. And so they picked Peter Pan from 1924, and he got programs from the time and studied the whole thing. And then he said, well, you produce the show for him, because I'd done so many different things. I said, sure. Well, we started on that, and then things turned over at the Eastman House, and James Card, who was the curator of film, had left. He's the man who actually started the whole Eastman House film collection. He left. John Kuiper came in from the Library of Congress. John came and said to Ray, would you like to start a project? And Ray said, I think it's a great idea. No. He had too much going because
he was
just
busy.
He had just started the master's program and he had all this stuff going on and he was writing yet. So he said to me, why don't you do it? So what I actually did was to learn from all of the music that is over in the library of the Eastman School, Orchestra Library, the original parts that were used by the Eastman Theater Orchestra from 1922 to 1929. And at that time, I mean, everything was handwritten, of course. Well, these were all printed music. And so the librarians would take the next cue and they would say Q14 and then draw a line down to where it started, over, cut to here, jump to here, do this and that. Well, these guys played this every day of the week, three times a day. So you could put anything in front of them and they could read it. They knew how to do it. So I decided that that's what I'm going to do and formed a 14-piece orchestra from Eastman students, which would represent your large neighborhood orchestra. The Eastman Theater Orchestra was 65 players, so they could play the symphonic repertoire, whereas a 14-piece orchestra doesn't. And so I learned all the techniques by just going through the cue sheets, which were sent along with films and et cetera, and started a second career, literally, doing that. And the way I feel about what I did and what Jeff does is we're the two opposite ends of the history of film scoring. I'm working in the teens and the 20s till sound came in, and that's how it was done. And it's all documented, it's everything. Jeff is working today and tomorrow, but the techniques he's using are almost all the same, basically, from using lead sheets, cue sheets, spotting sheets, whatever you want to call them. And so where I used published material, he composes the new material.
You're hearing from Donald Huntsberger, Professor Emeritus of Conducting at Eastman, about, again, the approach that we're going to see Sunday night, some of the themes that we'll see with music from film and how it's changed throughout history, but also, as Don says, in many ways, how some of the things are the same. Let's talk a little bit about, let's get specific about House of Cards, because we've already had a lot of listener questions, and if you're just joining us, Jeff and Joan are the team behind, well, Jeff and Joan and their son are the team behind the music. You joked in the NPR interview that you're like the Von Trapps of television music. That opening bass line is your son?
Yes. Yeah, he played electric bass on that for me.
So he's playing the electric bass, and he is a college student?
Yes, he's at the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas.
And
right now.
Is he actually recording? Is he coming in to record with you in California, or is he recording?
Yes, and since he went to college, and we enjoyed working together so much, and probably because more about me than him, because I missed my son, and it's a great way to stay in touch with your kid, to put him to work, you know. But he's good with technology, so I actually was able to send him some files, and actually he's done some recording for me in his dorm room.
In his dorm room.
Yeah, both of House of Cards, and he actually recorded his acoustic bass for me in another project.
So the opening bass notes we're hearing on the House of Cards theme?
That was when he was still in high school, so he did that at the house.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's him.
That's Henry. Yeah, he's talented. He's a talented kid and a great sight reader, and a friend of mine who's a wonderful musician in L.A., Dan Higgins, who plays in the studios all the time. He actually gave me the idea. I said, Dan, I don't want to mentor my son, but, you know, your teenage kid, you're an idiot by definition, you know, by being their father. So I said, how do I, you know, he said, just bring him in on a job, because then it's dad and son working. And that's what I tried. And that was great. We had a great relationship.
Pays those college bills.
I know. And it's
and that's
right. So now when he calls me and he needs some more money, I say, okay, well, yeah, good. I'm sending you some more cues. Earn your way.
Well, the score for House of Cards has become so popular that if you just search House of Cards theme on Twitter, you find some interesting things, and I'd like to share a few of those.
Oh my God!
These are not cherry picked. This is the first half dozen or so.
Okay.
These are actual tweets. If someone were to ask me to prom, it would have to be House of Cards theme oriented. I could run a marathon, publish 6 novels, and backpack 3/4 of Europe before the House of Cards theme song is over.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
You haven't lived until you've watched my son dance to the House of Cards theme song. Even though I gave up on House of Cards, I'm going to miss the theme song, someone writes. Don't give up on House of Cards.
No.
Love the House of Cards theme music during the MLB replay challenge at the Rangers game last night. Did you know that the Texas Rangers are using your music for their replay challenge?
No, and the implication is probably going to be somebody's going to die if they don't get this right.
That'll be the riff.
Yes.
Yeah. Heads will roll.
Yes. And then the last one. Whenever I drive in downtown D.C., I put on the House of Cards theme to make me feel special. Just rolling through the streets of D.C. Those are the first 6 that I found.
Gosh, that's a riot.
And there are hundreds. People are talking about the music. Let's bring it up again. Let's listen to a little bit of it here and try to answer some of the we've had a couple of questions already, just people wanting to sort of reestablish whether you knew about the show's themes or had seen any of it before you're composing it all. And Val, if you want, let's just listen underneath. Let's pull it. There you go. What did you know about the actual content of the show before this music was born?
Yeah, of course they had not filmed, but I had 4 scripts, so. There were some things that changed with various storylines, especially with, like, Peter Russo's character.
Oh, interesting.
But I knew that there was going to be a guy set up as a sort of paper tiger politician by Frank. And I knew, so from these 4 scripts, I knew who, I sort of had an idea of who Frank and Claire were. There's a great atmosphere in that relationship. One of the themes I wrote, one of my other favorite themes from the score, is you can hear it in the pilot when Frank comes home and finally has to tell Claire that he didn't get the Secretary of State job, and he sort of has his dark night of the soul. He bashes a lamp and sort of smokes, stays up all night plotting.
Because he doesn't lose.
He does not lose, and it's this sort of brooding, almost film noirish type piece. And it was not really what Fincher had asked for, but after reading the scripts, I just felt like this world feels sort of dark and sexy and sophisticated to me, the way they're written. So a lot of the show flows from the writing and then the acting. So, you know, it's funny. I usually know basically what's going to happen. Last season especially, you know, I had access to, like, what's called the story Bible, so I knew all the plot points of season 3, which was... I hated having to keep that secret for so long, but it's helpful because one of the things I like we do, we don't sort of regurgitate the same music every season. Every season, I write a lot of new music, mostly new music, and so it's all related. It's all from the same fabric, but as the stories evolve, we sort of let the music follow suit.
Do you remember the first time you saw the actual cinematography that went with your score?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Because it is beautiful.
It's stunningly beautiful. And, you know, one of the cool things at the very end that Fincher did with it, which I really loved, and I wasn't sure how it was going to feel because he's got such a great eye. And he says, man, I'm going to see if we can paint out all the people. Like, so a lot of those exterior shots, the time-lapse shots, there would be people, like, and still you see that in some of the nighttime shots, like the cars are rushing by.
Cars, mm-hmm.
But basically, so this is really, you know, a ton of work, but that's David Fincher, you know, he's such a perfectionist and so amazing. So that was one element that came in at the very end when it just makes those some of those exterior shots feel so ghostly because there's no one there. There's no people. You know, and that to me, I think one of the things that really works so well about the title sequence is it's the spirit of the show is you see these beautiful sort of iconic things, but you see them in a context which just feels a little off, you know. And it takes something that's familiar but surprises you.
So you will have again that plot Bible. You'll be composing for moments, or at least for themes. So, you know, there either a death scene or some sort of a dramatic confrontation. A super awkward three-way, whatever it is.
Yeah, that was one of them.
That's not something you go to college thinking I'm going to compose.
That was
for
a fun one, you know, for that scene, which is a very strange scene. You know, like I wrote like a. I mean, you know, that was like straight out. That was like Wagner, Tristan and Isolde, like grand opera, like that really weird, twisted chromatic harmony and the strings, and just felt right for that. So, yeah, I mean, really, every new episode has about 30 minutes of original underscore on it. Under it, you don't notice it as much as the theme music, but that's probably the thing I'm most proud of.
I wouldn't have said 30 minutes. You're right. Yeah. I would have said maybe 15. That's
no, it's a lot of music in the show, but it's not always designed to pull your attention away. A lot of it's in support of dialogue and. It's part of the fabric, you know. But there's a mood to the show that's really fun. It's almost like we're always trying to keep that sense of expectation and dread. And like what Don said, described so beautifully, he's like, oh, I want to know what's going to happen next. That's a lot of what we're doing is just sort of holding in suspense a lot of story and framing things, you know. Like you mentioned, Doug Stamper, I love Michael Kelly's performance. So there's a lot of great moments in just like season two where he's just sort of wandering around so in love with this gal, Rachel.
Obsessed with her.
It's so unrequited, and he's so tragic. And it's like a scene where there's, you know, it's maybe two, it runs on for most TV shows would give you 10 seconds of that. And we're in there for a minute with just Doug sitting around drinking or walking through a room. And those are like, as a composer, those are your golden opportunities because that's just like enter music, you know.
And I've read that you do a lot of the work on your own. You play a lot of the instrumentation is you?
Well, I play the piano and the trumpet.
Okay.
And all the electronics. Like most composers today, I play in all my other parts. And then I orchestrate and record a string section on all the episodes.
And I want to know how much Joan gets to be. Do you have veto power on some of the themes, Joan? Do you come in? No?
Absolutely not.
No.
You know, as a matter of fact, Jeff wouldn't tell me anything that was going to happen. And when we recorded season three vocals, I actually stood behind the screen so I wouldn't see what was happening.
Especially because, for the finale. I didn't want to see what happened in the
because
finale.
Because his whole thing is he wants his audience, and that's me included, to experience it when it's done, when it's cooked. And so I waited, and he had to carry the terrible knowledge of what was going to happen.
Why do you say it's terrible? Yeah. Maybe it was good news.
Or maybe good knowledge, or maybe whatever. But he, you know, he keeps it secret, and he takes that very seriously. So, Henry and I have no idea what's happening.
Now, can I ask an ignorant question? I apologize. You mentioned you stay behind the screen, and in my head I'm thinking there must be certain scenes where you're composing general concepts, you know, a murder or like that dark, obsessive Doug Stamper stuff. But are there scenes where you need to be, there needs to be a tonal change right on time with certain things?
Oh, a lot of things happen. The choreography, and that's very typical of film scoring these days. Any day, there's a lot of times you're hitting certain moments in a scene. That's really the art of it, you know, is how do you, okay, you've got to be, got to have this tone playing for exactly 43 seconds, and right at this minute, this dramatic change. And it's not like the music is always married to everything that happens on screen, but it should be married to the big what we call them story beats, you know. So a good score knows what those beats are and is some way addressing them. Yeah.
And Joan, is that what you meant with the screen? I want to make sure I understand when you say you wanted to stay behind the screen.
So, yeah, just a video monitor was showing the
moment on the show.
Yeah.
So you could be seeing it.
I could. Okay. I could stick my head around the corner and watch what was happening. But this is typical for Jeff. He likes everybody to wait until it's all done.
John says, the show is amazing, and I hope Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright have sent you a thank you card. You are a big part of their success.
I've met them both, and they're very appreciative. Thank you.
That's really sweet.
Yeah, that's really nice.
But you probably don't have to see them very much. I mean, you're sort of remote.
No,
I mean,
it's actually really sweet. I got a nice bottle. In fact, Kevin sent me a bottle of champagne when I was nominated for an Emmy last year, which was really nice. And we just both saw them in London. I happened to be there for a premiere of a choral work, and we had a premiere there, and I saw both Kevin and Robin. And yeah, I mean, I don't know Kevin that well, and in some ways I don't feel like I need to. He kind of scares me because he's so intense and he's so talented. But I kind of like the fact that my relationship with them is not with them as people or actors. It's kind of with the characters they play. So that's kind of like the nature of our relationship. You know, is that I'm invested in that thing they've created. You know.
Although Robin Wright does say that your music gives her chills, honey.
That's true.
So,
she has.
You know,
that was nice to hear.
She came
nice
up to me and just said, I love your husband. So I said, gee, Robin, huh?
That is a great. I actually, the first time I saw Kevin Spacey outside of House of Cards recently, since I started watching House of Cards, I had to watch for a class that I'm teaching. I wanted to show a speech Kevin Spacey gave on storytelling. And so it was just 5 minutes, and I watched it, and I thought, that's not what he sounds like. It was fascinating to watch him as not Frank Underwood. I was so locked into the accent.
Yeah, in fact,
I bought it.
He's amazing. I mean, yeah, you know, Glengarry, Glenn Ross, American Beauty. He's created he's created some amazing characters. We saw him do a one-man show at the Old Vic in London of Clarence Darrow, which was just, that was a real thrill, because I definitely study actors. I mean, I feel like being a jazz trumpet player, I often tell people that that's a good metaphor for what it feels like to be a film composer, because I'm really trying to take in everything that's happening around me and be a part of that band, if you will. And so to be in the same room and watch Kevin do this sort of tour de force play, a one-man show, it was just really, really incredible.
I'm way late for a break. Let's take a very short break and come right back with Jeff and Joan Beal. There's so much more to talk about. We're going to hear more of Jeff's work on other shows, and we're going to talk about how you end up going from the Eastman School to this line of work. It has certainly become a popular destination for a lot of people who are studying music, but how did Jeff end up doing this? How did Joan end up doing this? Donald Huntsberger's here as well. He's a professor emeritus of conducting at Eastman, and they are building up for a big event on Sunday night. It is free at 8 o'clock at the Eastman School of Music's Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater, a free concert, an evening of film and film music. And there's one other part of the story that we haven't gotten to yet, and we're going to talk about how Jeff and Joan have dealt with an unexpected challenge, we'll say, and how they are dealing with that as well. So much more to talk about here on Connections. Lauren on Twitter says, the House of Cards theme song gets me all sorts of hyped. I could do this all day, Jeff, if you want.
Go ahead.
I can just spend the next 20 minutes just reading tweets.
It's hysterical.
Nikki says, relationship status high on the title theme of House of Cards. Just amazing. Hundreds upon hundreds of comments about Jeff and Joan's work there. As we're talking to Jeff and Joan Beal, they're back in Rochester. They went to the Eastman School of Music in the 1980s, met there. If you missed Joan's fabulous story of how they met, what a great story. And they're back here this week. You're in residence this week. You're going to be talking to students. What are you guys going to be doing?
I was teaching this morning. Joan and I are giving master classes. I was teaching some film scoring students this morning. I'm in preparation for the concert. We've got about 80 students playing in the orchestra, so I'm going to be conducting and rehearsing with them all week. Yeah, it's really fun. You know, I've never had a full-time teaching job, but I think when you get to a certain point in career, you feel like you've learned enough that it's time to start, you want to start, you know, get preparing the next generation. So it was fun. I was teaching some film scoring students this morning, and some of things never changed. Like Don mentioned about the silent movie, or I just was going right back to things I learned from Rayburn Wright about film scoring. Some of those same things I was passing those along, you know. And then Joan, you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I'll get to talk to the vocal students about I'm calling it my 21st century toolkit for singers. Some of the things that they can take after they leave the school and bring into careers as singers, and some of the things that are now changing for singers, and the things that are staying the same. It's very similar to what Jeff's talking about, the continuity of the canon at Eastman, where we learn the real skills, the real literature, the real rep, and how to be a consummate musician. And then how the world and the changing of technology and media influences us. So it's an exciting time to be a musician, and I'm excited to meet the kids.
What is the biggest difference for you compared to when you were in school in singing careers, Joan?
Well, I would say that the flexibility that we're afforded now. Jeff and I were at school with Renee Fleming, and when we were at school with her, we used to joke that, you know, we wanted to sing jazz or pop music, but the vocal professors weren't necessarily that enthusiastic about it. Well, now, you know, Renee's put together this American Voices program at the Kennedy Center, where they're looking at how you can sing with great technique and stylistic. Stylistically, you can sing on Broadway, you can sing musical theater, you can sing leader. So a good technique is something that provides the foundation, and then you can sing in any sort of style with that.
Well, let's listen to some of Jeff's other work, and we'll talk about the destination of students in this kind of a genre, in this kind of an industry, because it's not all House of Cards. He's got a long, long list of shows and films that he's worked with, and they're not all as dark and Machiavellian as House of Cards. In fact, let's flip it 180 degrees the other way, and that is Monk.
Yay.
Let's listen to the theme from Monk. That, of course, the theme from Monk, and what obviously if we know the show, we get a sense for some of the personality there. But for those who don't know the show that well, what are you going for here, Jeff?
Well, you know, this character is, there's a wink to this character the way Tony Shalhoub plays him. He's a detective who suffers from OCD, and he's also sort of, he's almost like from another era. He sort of lives out of time, even though it's a contemporary show. He has this sort of almost nostalgic sense of naivete about him, which is really fun. So this idea of a Django Reinhardt sort of piece of music just felt right for his character. And it's bouncy and fun, but I think the best description anybody ever gave of it, you know, was that it just feels neat and tidy. You know, it's very Monk. It's very Monk. It's very structured. The structure of the composition is very symmetrical. Everything's in its place, you know. So it's got that sort of, you know, order. House of Cards is sort of like, oh, dark, and there's all these things that come out from you from the hallways and the angles. And, you know, this is like, you know, just like an OCD person would be. Clean, two instruments, bang. There's actually a fun Rochester connection. You know, the guitarist, a wonderful guitarist playing, this is a guy by the name of Grant Geisman, who cut his teeth much younger in his earlier years playing guitar with Chuck Mangione.
Oh,
he actually played the guitar solo on Feels So Good, if you can believe that. For those of you who, like me, who were old enough to remember that.
That was my favorite album.
Hit of Chuck's from many days ago.
Well, if you were to take House of Cards and put it in the cradle of civilization, it might be Rome.
Yeah.
And so let's turn back to something a little darker, and let's listen to Rome. This is a show I haven't seen, so I get a sense for what you're going for here, but tell us about it.
Yeah, it was interesting because that was part of actually me. This is part of the, this. There's an interesting story because this show is kind of how I met David Fincher, because the wonderful title design was done by this guy, Angus Wall, who is also a video editor, works with David, and sort of because of that, I got on that commercial with David. But It's a good one to sort of compare and contrast, because, you know, up till we sort of now with all these shows like Game of Thrones and Vikings and what have you, you know, sort of become more commonplace. But at the time the HBO did this show, the only sort of real film versions of this part of history all felt like they were all white togas and white marble, and it was this sort of gloss of the golden age of cinema. And HBO, being HBO, they sort of wanted to do the grittier street level version of Rome. And with a contemporary sensibility to the show, so that it's a show, it's a very political show. It's also about class. It's about the sort of tension between the plebeians sort of, and then the patricians. You know, so you have this sort of, it's very sort of modern in the sense that there's a wealth gap, there's privilege, there's stabbings. It's not that, you know, Caesar, you know, he didn't have a too good of an ending, you know, so it's not.
He probably wanted it to go another way.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in a lot of ways, nothing has really changed in this. There's some of this, and it's also sort of Shakespearean, you know, obviously, you know. So this idea that it had that drama, when I wrote Fincher after the commercial and I saw this thing, I said, after doing two seasons of Rome, I'd love to do another political drama because I feel like it's so rich. So, you know, lucky for me that he responded. And
good call.
Yeah.
Good call with House of Cards. Donald Huntsberger, when you look at the way students are approaching their own careers, you know, and in a second we're going to ask Jeff and Joan just how quickly after Eastman they moved into this field, because I don't know the answer to that. I'm very curious about that. But what historically has been the approach that students have been taking to this? What percentage of students who are coming through Eastman are actually thinking about film and scoring for television? Is this still a small set? Is it growing?
I believe it's growing. The problem that occurred, if you go back far enough, back into the 50s and 60s, and I have another secret. Joan's father and uncle were in my class. We graduated together.
We won't tell any stories, I promise.
There you go. The interesting thing is that everybody who comes to any music school is going to end up in the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony. If you're a wind brass percussion player, that would be your goal. If you're a string player, well, you might do that, but you would really rather be a solo violinist or solo cellist, or be in a chamber music group or something of the kind. And it's that high level of expectation. Like people would say, well, singers don't have to learn how to sing in a chorus, yeah, or a chorale, because there are no jobs. The opera is the only thing. Well,
not true.
Not true.
That's a great point. Yeah.
So the thing that sort of grew over the last decades of the last century, and Ray was one of the people who really pushed this, is that you have to be prepared as a performer to sit down and meet any challenge that is put on a music stand in front of you. If you can do that, and you've been lucky enough to be invited to play a job, you might be invited to play a second time. If you don't do well, you're gone.
Yep.
Yeah. You're gone. Well, the thing for the United States and other countries, I think, who have all these good music schools, is that many, many people do not end up in the symphony orchestras. They do not end up singing at the Met, but they go into allied areas in education, in industry, but they still keep up their playing and singing. So they enrich the communities that they've gone into very, very much. And it just, I mean, you can go out and they have what various levels of orchestras, mm-hmm, for example, in the United States. And one of the levels is called regional orchestra. And a regional orchestra down in Texas is the Austin, not the Austin Symphony, that is a small city orchestra, but there's an amateur orchestra also. And those people come in, they don't get paid that much, if they get paid at all.
Yeah.
And they're playing for the, you know, for the love of doing it, and because they were trained so well. And so that's sort of what is always my goal anyway, is you learn how to play your instrument in the studio, you learn the repertoire through the ensembles you're in and the groups I worked with. We played everything under the sun, whether you liked it or not. Well, many times I didn't like it.
Well, you hope you like it, and you hope you do get paid. How quickly after Eastman did this become a career for you?
You know, I was also a trumpet player, so I was also sort of on a dual track for several years, making some jazz trumpet records. But I always knew that composing was sort of at the heart of what I wanted to do. I think we did not move to Los Angeles right away, so in a way, it might have taken a little longer. But it feels about like it takes a long while to really get established as a composer. I think by the time I was in my early 30s, I was really starting to work regularly, and it just sort of built from there. But like what Don said, you know, I feel like the best training for doing what I do is being a great musician, really knowing your stuff. So, you know, I felt like I want to be the best composer I can be. So as I was making those relationships and people were learning about me in the film world, I was still making my records, doing concert commissions and other things, just being a music maker, you know. And when the film projects got interesting enough and great enough, I got the same sort of collaborative joy that I used to get from other things that maybe I don't do as much anymore, like being a jazz trumpet player, things mm-hmm. like that. You know, it's a long time. I think it's probably one of the most exciting times for a young composer to be going into these fields, and it's incredibly competitive. I feel like I won the lottery in a lot of ways. I mean, everybody would love to do what I do, of course. But, you know, it was really funny. There was one of these surveys on the fastest growing jobs, and I couldn't believe it. Composer was one of the listings. And I can only imagine that crept in, because when there's probably never been more content created in all sort types of media. We're talking film and TV, video games, which mm-hmm. on a dollar-for-dollar basis is already bigger than the film business.
Yep.
Cable, internet, I mean, you name it. House of Cards is we're a streaming show. We don't even really have a broadcast. So, you know, we live in a media culture, so the idea that the composer of the future is going to somehow engage that makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. to me.
And the same thing for the performer, too. I mean, I was a choral singer, and like Don said, I loved choral music. I saw absolutely nothing wrong with it. I enjoyed singing in ensembles. I sang with the San Francisco Opera Chorus, and I started doing opera for commercials. That's how I got into the business as an opera singer. And then when we moved to Los Angeles, a natural outgrowth from that was going into the studios, and I was what they called the reader, because I could sight read music. So they would bring me into the session and I would sing in a gospel choir and I would be the voice that would follow the music and help everybody else learn their parts. So that's kind of how I got started as a classically trained singer. I was able to not sing with my big operatic voice. I had flexibility. I could blend. And I got hired. So, and then I started contracting choirs and being a choir master. And now I mentor and help other singers get where I got to.
Well, and I, as I mentioned earlier, Jeff and Joan are such a team in what they do. And from everything I've read and seen, you're a team in how you've been managing MS. And that diagnosis came for Jeff. Cause I look at you, you sit here, you're fit, you're really, you know, I don't see anything that would indicate, but your multiple sclerosis diagnosis came how long ago?
About 8 years ago, yeah.
A surprise?
Very. I mean, although it's a strange condition until you have something dramatic, you know, to find it. I mean, looking back in my history, I can say, okay, maybe that explains why the fatigue was an issue or this or that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you know, it's a relatively young person's disease. So I was about in my mid-40s at the time, and it was quite terrifying. I mean, I have a second cousin that has it, so I knew it was something you can manage. But the early years were especially terrifying because, you know, there's some courses of this where I've, you know, that go much more quickly. Luckily, I have a slow progression.
Yep.
You know, which is great. So, you know, it is what it is, you know, and we're doing, you know, Joan being, you find out how much somebody loves you when something like this happens to you.
I've heard her talk about this. I've only got about 90 seconds left, but she has talked really interestingly to me about your willingness to try a lot of different approaches, even though some people may say, well, such and such will work, such and such not really. You've tried a lot of different things.
Yeah, so for Jeff, I saw a vascular connection, which was really obvious from his blood results and from all sorts of things. So we decided to pursue that and a cardiovascular health program, which, you know what, it benefits everyone. Exercise, eating well, stress reduction, and it's benefited Jeff, and we're happy to help other people. So.
And you feel good?
I feel really good, thank you. And I think, you know, the funny thing is that I think music in its own way is probably one of the best things I can do because, you know, we've learned so much about neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to rewire itself. So every day that I go to work and write, I'm keeping those circuits active and healing.
Absolutely.
So that's a good thing.
And you've got plenty of work because I just saw a couple weeks ago, season 4 of House of Cards
has been
confirmed.
Yes.
Joan is celebrating over there. I couldn't believe it was actually in doubt, but you never know until it happens. So real briefly, what does that mean for you? What kind of schedule are you on with that?
Yeah. Well, as you know, everybody dies in season 4. No, I'm just kidding.
Don't tell him, honey.
I have not seen a script. I literally don't know anything that's going to happen, but I assume in the next few weeks, Bo and I will have a little conversation. They will start shooting probably in June, and I will be writing from then until January of next year when we'll drop the next 13.
Wow. Yeah. So that seems to move pretty quickly, at least for their start to that process, June already.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes a long time to make 13 hours of the quality that they do, to film them the way they do and to post them the way they do, so... Yeah,
a lot of work, but great fun.
Love it. It's one of the best jobs I've ever had. Not only is it a great show, but I have such a long creative leash, and that is just amazing.
That's interesting because, look, 15 seconds, you opened up a question I should have thought to ask, but I didn't think of, which is, had they ever come back to you and said, I don't think this works?
Oh, sure. Yeah? I get notes, yeah, but and you want to get notes that make you better, but you want to get notes that waste your time, and they don't waste anybody's time there. They're like Frank Underwood's. Get to the point. Get it done. Like we wish our politicians were.
Jeff and Joan Beal are here in Rochester this week, and Rochester's thrilled to have you back at the Eastman School in Residence for the week, and then Sunday night they're going to join Don Huntsberger and 80 musicians or more.
Yeah.
So
Eastman Film Music.
Yeah, you can go out and see them. An evening of film and film music, 8 p.m. Sunday, the Eastman School of Music's Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater, free and open to the public. Don, great to meet you. Thank you for being here. Jeff and Joan, congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
And your music can play us out. Have a great day, everyone.